I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'm thankful for you guys that thought it was worthwhile to be here at the very first session of the morning. I know for some of you, particularly those of you that are even younger than I, when you're out at a meeting, probably being there at the 8 o'clock session isn't your first priority. So I appreciate those that made it a priority this morning. I remember when I was driving from the Denver airport yesterday, my first range beef cow symposium was actually here in 2007. And that was just right before I started at UNL. I've always liked this meeting because of the class of producer that it draws. So, again, appreciate the opportunity to talk to you this morning about economically relevant traits and selection indices. I assume that a lot of this is going to be review for many of you, but in part I want to maybe set some seeds for discussion later on at the bullpen session. So since I'm the first genetic speaker of the morning, I feel obligated to lay out a fundamental principle. Phenotype, or what we see, is really the summation of both genetics and environmental effects. And that, by itself, illustrates the fundamental flaw with selecting on raw phenotypes. Okay? When we select on raw phenotypes inherently, we're selecting bulls based not only on their genetic merit, but also the environmental benefits or detriments that they were afforded. So if we break phenotype down even further and say that it's really equal to the mean of a population plus the animal's breeding value, or really their genetic merit, plus the environment, obviously there's one of those pieces we want to use to select our next herd sire, and that's their breeding value, or what we use in the beef industry is an EPD, which is essentially half of an estimated breeding value. That is beyond contestation. Right? For those in the audience that think it still may be worthwhile to select a bull based on their actual birth weight, that's akin to trying to make the argument that the world is indeed flat and at the end of the map there's dragons that eat ships. Okay? There is no argument for it. The other thing that you guys have to realize is that for commercial cow-calf producers, there's more than just one trait that impacts your bottom line. It would be much simpler for you if there was only one magical trait that impacted your profitability, but the fact of the matter is there's a multitude of them. Oop, I got ahead of myself there a little bit. So how do you begin? Well, you have to clearly identify what your breeding and marketing goals are. So when do you sell calves? Do you retain replacement heifers? Do you sell calves based on some kind of value-based grid? Those kinds of things need to be identified ahead of time. Once you identify that, you can begin to form a list of the traits that actually impact both costs and revenues. And we'll get into what those may be. And then also clearly identify if there are environmental constraints that impact your operation. So if you're in an environment that does not afford you a lot of forage, okay, if you're in a high-stress environment, low feed availability, then you may need to put an upper bound on things like maternal weaning weight or milk EPDs. Right, I'd like to, for those of you that haven't heard it before, introduce a phrase or a term, economically relevant traits, first proposed by Bruce Gold and others in about 2000. And really what an economically relevant trait, or an ERT, is a trait that's directly associated with either a cost of production or a revenue stream. And the key is it's directly related to that. So let's look at a few examples. So the first one here, birth weight versus calving ease. How many think birth weight is an economically relevant trait? Okay. How many of you think calving ease is an economically relevant trait? Okay, if we were taking a pure vote, this is democratic society, right? Calving ease would win. And I would tend to agree with those people. The reason is I don't directly get paid for birth weight. I don't sell calves the day they're born by the pound. So it does not generate a source of revenue for me. And the other thing is I don't have a direct cost associated with how big the calf is when it's born. What I do have a direct cost associated with is, did I have to provide assistance when that calf was born? That's calving ease. Did I actually have to provide labor? Was there a severe event that caused mortality of calf or cow? Those kinds of things have a direct cost associated with them. As a consequence, we would say calving ease is the economically relevant trait, and birth weight is an indicator of it. Now, what about ribeye area versus yield grade? I don't think any of us get paid based on increasing or decreasing ribeye area, but there are premiums and discounts for yield grade. And ribeye, obviously, is a component of the yield grade equation, as a consequence, an indicator of it. So in this case, yield grade would be an economically relevant trait. Ribeye area would be an indicator. Now, what about yearling weight versus carcass weight? That one's trickier, isn't it? From an industry perspective, there's no doubt carcass weight is the ERT, from an industry perspective. However, from an individual enterprise perspective, if you don't retain ownership to the end and you sell calves at yearling, or maybe you sell them earlier at weaning, then that point at which you sell them, that sale weight point, is the ERT for you. That's unfortunate, isn't it? In a segmented industry where we may not have full convergence of what is economically relevant to an industry as a whole versus what's economically relevant to an individual enterprise. Mature weight versus dry matter intake. Mature weight is an indicator of maintenance energy requirements, but what I really have to pay for is the feed for the cow. Residual feed intake versus feed intake. We're talking about growing cattle now. This is an interesting one. Feed intake or dry matter intake is the economically relevant trait, not residual feed intake. You guys don't pay feed bills based on the residual. You pay feed bills based on what they actually ate. That's the differentiation. Here's a problem in the discussion of economically relevant traits. Many that are economically relevant to the industry are not currently evaluated or collected routinely in seed stock settings. So I think about things like reproduction phenotypes, reproductive longevity. I would argue the best place to collect that data is in commercial herds, not in seed stock herds. Seed stock herds should turn over cows more rapidly to decrease generation interval, make faster genetic change. Commercial cattlemen, you're trying to depreciate that cow out and get her to last as long as she can. Ideally, that's where the data would come from. Things like disease, and maybe you've heard some about bovine respiratory disease and the research efforts to uncover genetic selection tools for that. And one of the problems is we don't have a lot of phenotypes for that, but routinely every day in this industry we're collecting disease phenotypes at the feedlot level. They may not be the cleanest in the world. They may just be simply pulls, treatments, mortality, but we're collecting that data. It would be nice if we could migrate that data into our national cattle evaluation. Routine carcass data, again, it's collected every day, just not in seed stock settings. And then finally, other things that drive downstream plant value, like primal yield, dart cutters, blood splashes, things like that, we don't collect in seed stock settings, but we do collect in this industry. And so the point here is there needs to be a concerted effort going forward to be able to get the data we collect every day that drives downstream value into our national cattle evaluation. And I would tell you right now that that effort, if successful, would have a much larger impact on our national cattle evaluation than a lot of the things that I work on a day-to-day basis, like genomics. All right, indicator traits. These are traits that are genetically correlated to an economically relevant trait. And so the question is, why would we use these at all? Well, a few reasons. Maybe they can be measured earlier in life. There's an indicator of reproductive longevity. Maybe we can collect it on the female far earlier in life. Maybe it's just cheaper and easier to measure. Maybe the economically relevant trait is just too expensive to measure routinely. Maybe there's some traits we can only measure on one sex. They're sex limited, but there's an indicator trait that we could actually measure on both sexes. That has a huge advantage in terms of the rate of genetic change we can make. And the last thing, because I'm an animal breeder and I have to throw out things that may be confusing, if by chance the co-heritability is greater than the heritability of the economically relevant trait, And the co-heritability is just a function of the heritability of the ERT, the heritability of the indicator trait, and their genetic correlation. If that happens to be greater than the heritability of the ERT itself, then it makes sense to use an indicator trait. Very rarely is that the case. Most of the times we use indicator traits for the three more pragmatic reasons I listed before. I just want to quickly show you some tools we have to compare EPDs across breed. And I throw up this slide that discusses how we come about the crossbreed adjustment factors that are developed at U.S. MARC and released on an annual basis on the at the Beef Improvement Federation annual meeting. What these equations basically show you is that we take the sire of breed effects or breed of sire effects at U.S. MARC, and we basically adjust the EPDs for that breed based on which bulls from that breed were sampled and used at U.S. MARC in their germplasm evaluation project, and then we put it on an Angus base. The big thing I want to show to you guys in this equation, you'll see in the top a lowercase b, that's a regression coefficient, and that's the regression of crossbred progeny born at U.S. MARC on purebred sire EPD. So what that regression coefficient tells us is for every one unit change I make in an EPD, how much change do I make in crossbred offspring performance for that trait? And if that regression coefficient is 1, it says I change an EPD by 1 unit, and given enough calves, I make a 1 unit change in their phenotype. And guess what? For growth and carcass traits at U.S. MARC, that regression coefficient is very, very close to 1. So for those that still may question the value of EPDs, particularly in the production of crossbred offspring, time and time again we show that they work. This is a list, and I know it's hard to see, and I don't put it up there so you can copy everything down, but these are crossbreed adjustment factors for several breeds for birth weight, weaning weight, yearling weight, milk, and carcass traits. You'll see some gaps for some breeds. That means the breed either doesn't have an EPD for that trait, or they reported on a different base. For instance, they may not have a carcass EPD, they have an ultrasound EPD. Another point I want to make here is, unfortunately, a lot of these are for indicator traits, right? We have adjustment factors for birth weight, but not for calving ease. And I just told you to use calving ease EPD instead of birth weight EPD. So why is that? Why would they not have adjustment factors for some of the ERTs? We'll get to that in a moment. I just wanted to quickly remind you of how to use these. If we have two bulls, a Simmental bull and a Hereford bull, on the top we have their within-breed EPDs for birth, weaning, yearling, and milk. And then from the previous table, I add to those the adjustment factors for those respective breeds. I can put those two bulls on an Angus base and be able to fairly compare them. And before doing that, you'll see the two bulls' milk EPDs look very similar, but in fact, they're drastically different. So the problem with not having a crossbreed adjustment factors for some of the economically relevant traits is some of those economically relevant traits, the statistical models we use to derive EPDs for them vary considerably between breed organizations. And that creates a very large problem in terms of coming up with these crossbreed adjustment factors. I had a graduate student that finished close to a year ago that prototyped crossbreed adjustment factors for calving ease. And the thing I'd say is these breed associations develop collaborations amongst each other and have a combined or a multi-breed genetic evaluation. Some of these problems, not all of them, but some of these problems begin to alleviate themselves. And I'd say right now a lot of those collaborations are going on, and I think that's a very good thing for the beef industry. All right. If you're selecting, I said early on, there's more than one trait that impacts your profitability. If I'm in a terminal breeding program, here's what I think the list of traits that are economically relevant to me are. And some of those we have EPDs for, some we don't. We have EPDs for obviously growth traits, calving ease traits. Some breeds have a feed efficiency or feed intake metric. But we really don't have direct EPDs for disease susceptibility or calf survival, but crossbreeding can help those some. If I'm in a maternal breeding program, here's the list, and it's a longer list of traits that are economically relevant to me. Again, the ones in blue are the ones that we currently have EPDs for. And so this just illustrates there's a lot of traits or a lot of trait complexes that you need to focus on, and there's a few different ways to do that. One is tandem selection. It says, I'm going to pick one of those traits. I'm going to select on it till I get it to the level I want. Then I'm going to forget about it and go to the second trait on my list. That's a horribly inefficient way of practicing multiple trait selection. You can actually erode progress in the first trait once you start selecting on the second one. The second way is independent culling levels, and we'll discuss that in a bit more detail. And then, of course, the third are selection indices. So this is an example from Mosier about 10 years ago where he illustrated independent culling levels. There are five traits here. The numbers at the top show what our threshold is. And so to select a bull, he has to meet or exceed every single one of those thresholds. The problem is, if you look here on the list, bull number four didn't meet our threshold for calving ease direct. A higher number is better. So we take him off our list. But actually, if we look at the economic index at the end, Hereford's Baldy Maternal Index, economically, he was the best choice. So a selection index allows for superior performance in one trait to offset maybe less than average performance in another, because they're weighted based on their relative economic importance. So selection indices, first proposed in 1943 by a very talented, at that time, animal breeding student, Lenoy Hazel, wrote a dissertation that his advisor couldn't understand and revolutionized the way we think about multiple trait selection. Came up with selection index theory, where we weight the traits according to their economic importance. So if we have a scenario where we retain ownership, sell on a grid, the traits that belong in the index are things related to carcass weight, carcass quality, carcass yield, and feed intake. And those are weighted, again, based on their relative economic importance. Fundamentally, what we're after is something that takes into account the salvage value of cows, what they're worth in terms of lean value, the number of progeny they have, their value, and feed intake for both the cow herd and the progeny. Weber's going to focus on this next, but you know the greatest way to improve overall efficiency of the cow-calf enterprise? Have more calves. And I don't mean just have more cows, right? Have more calves. So have more successful pregnancies. And a way to do that, of course, Bob, I'm getting my plug in, crossbreed. So how do these economic indices come about? Well, we use simulation. And anytime I say simulation in front of a producer group, they say fictitious. No, that the simulation is actually built on industry parameters. So we build a 1,000 or 20,000 cow herd via simulation, and we say the mean level of performance for that herd is going to be what we may see in the industry as a whole, so using data from USDA or other published research. And we basically ask the question, if we perturb one of the traits, let's say carcass weight, by one unit and hold everything else constant, how much does that change the profitability of that simulated herd? That change in profitability by increasing carcass weight one unit becomes the economic value of carcass weight. Then we go through and we say, well, let's change yield grade by one unit, everything else constant. Then change quality grade by one unit, everything else constant. And we do that several times and get the average of those. And that's how we come up with the economic values that drive your selection indices. This is a list, and I think it's fairly all-inclusive, of the economic indices available in the beef industry right now. I have the breed listed, and I've delineated them between being terminal and maternal in nature. That's an important delineation. If my breeding objective says I sell calves at weaning and I retain replacement heifers, I should use an index that makes those same assumptions. If instead I use an index that assumes that everything's terminal and I'm retaining ownership clear through the feeding phase, then I've made a huge mistake, because essentially I'm building replacement heifers based on an index that emphasized carcass weight. And that's probably not the right thing to have done. I'm going to wind up with replacement heifers that are far larger than what I ever wanted them to be. So economic indices are a powerful tool. They're a preferred tool to practice multiple trait selection, but you have to use the one that's the most appropriate for your personal breeding objectives. Here's an example, and I don't have favorites, all right, but this happens to be a Red Angus example, one of the relatively new economic indices that's been released. And this is their Herd Builder Index. It's the index designed if you are retaining replacement heifers and all culls then are going to be sold. So we have two bulls, Bull A and Bull B. Index value for Bull A is 134, for Bull B is 110. There's a 24-unit difference between them. If we make some assumptions and say that these bulls would each breed 30 cows per year over a four-year time horizon, that's 120 exposures per bull. So I take that number of exposures and multiply it by the difference in the index value between the two bulls, and I can quickly come to see that the value difference between them is about $2,800. Bull A is worth $2,800 more to me than Bull B is. So that's in profit per head. And that gives me an idea of how much more should I pay for Bull A compared to Bull B. Now, here's the flip side, though. What if Bull A sells for $10,000 more than Bull B? Maybe he's still number one on my list, but maybe he's not the best buy anymore. That's an odd thing, thinking about bull buying selection in terms of economics. I won't ask you to raise your hands how many of you do that, okay? Because we run a bull sale at UNL, and we have an auction because I hope you don't stop to think about which bull you can actually afford, right? But you guys need to think about it in that context when you're buying bulls. Improvement in current, and I mentioned this earlier, improvement in current indices can be made by increasing the number of economically relevant traits we have EPDs for. Things like input traits, things like fertility. And that's going to take collaboration, the likes of which we've never seen before across all segments of our beef industry. Enterprise-level profitability, so individual firm profitability, and industry-level profitability, we need to see a closer merger between those two. And what I mean by that, take the example of tenderness. There is no question that to our industry as a whole, tenderness is economically relevant. You talk to somebody that decided they don't like steak anymore, it's because they ate a tough one at a restaurant that cost them a lot of money. That's important to our industry. But unless you have some kind of niche value-added system that you market your calves through, you don't get paid for tenderness. Those kind of issues are problematic. So to summarize, and I haven't been paying attention to the young lady in front with the time cards, but I think I'm still okay. It's critical to establish production goals, right? Know where your current levels of production are, where the gaps are, have a true accounting for costs of production. That's something, generally speaking, we don't do a great job of. And use the economic indices that are available that truly fit your breeding objectives. The most popular economic index in our industry is Angus's Dollar Beef, and it is a very good terminal index. If you really are a completely terminal scenario that owns the cattle all the way through the end and markets on CAB, it is a great index. But if you sell at weaning, retain replacement heifers, it's not the index to use. And Angus has other indices that fit that. Don't make sire selection more cumbersome than it needs to be. The front part of my preceding paper was very facetious, and I talked about the differences between corn farmers and commercial cow-calf producers. I come from an operation in South Central Kansas that's both. And I never recall my dad having quizzed the guy that's selling seed corn as much as what we quiz the guy that's selling bulls. Okay? We know when we need to plant corn, we know where we need to plant it, and we order seed corn. But for some reason, when it comes to bull selection, we make things so much harder than they need to be. And we have tools like economic indices that help point us in the right direction. Don't forget them. And I mentioned again, but I'll mention it again now, or mention it before, I'll mention it again. Know your costs. And sire selection should be driven by profit potential. Just not trait change, but profit potential. Multiple trait selection is obviously critical to you guys. And anyone that's ever looked through a bull sale catalog or an AI stud catalog knows there's a bunch of data in there. There's some information, but a bunch of data. Okay, there's a difference between the two. Economic indices help alleviate the cumbersome nature of sorting through all of that. With that, I'll round out by showing just a few educational resources. One, our UNL beef production website, beef.unl.edu. A project Bob Weber and I are involved in, focused on genetic predictors for feed efficiency, beefefficiency.org. Of course, the National Beef Cattle Evaluation Consortium website, nbcec.org. And finally, a new educational resource called ebeef.org, just started this past June and really designed for you guys. And so as you take a look at it, if you see something, an educational resource that's missing that you'd really like to see, send us an email, because we'd like to know about it and either put up a webinar or a fact sheet that covers that topic. So I plan to be at the bullpen session tonight. To be honest, that's why I came. I always enjoy those, and I look forward to visiting with you guys there this evening. So thank you.